I would like to begin by having you look at just a brief verse or two of Scripture. It's in Philippians and the first chapter. You may have already read these verses because our beloved pastor included these verses in the newsletter for the church that he sent out, I think, last Friday. I had already written this down as what I would launch with, and it's kind of reassuring to know that once in a while my mind moves along that of the great masters, our pastor in that regard. But I would like to begin by reading Philippians chapter 1 and verses 6 and 7. Just a brief statement. There are a couple words there that shape what I would like to start with in the opening. So, perhaps familiar, verse 6, "For I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perform it or perfect it until the day of Jesus Christ." And then Paul says, "For it is only right for me to feel this way about you all, because I have you in my heart, since both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you are partakers of grace with me." Well, we want to grow in our knowledge and grounding in the Word of God in this series, and this is one of the ways He's perfecting us until that day of Christ. That's the day when He will come and call the church to be with Himself. And then I'm particularly focusing on words that appear in verse 7. Paul talks about the defense and confirmation of the gospel. You see, Christianity is a life belief system that claims to be true. And truth is something that, you know, almost by definition, is open to proof. For truth is, it's never irrational. Truth is never illogical. Truth is never contradictory. So truth is something that is provable. It can stand a proof. It might even be in need of a proof. So the Christian life and belief system needs a Christian apologetic. And that's what he says here, because he uses these words, defense and confirmation. The word for defense is apologia, or an apology. It's a legal argument. It's a legal term for referring to a formal defense in a court context. And that's what Paul is saying that he's doing with the gospel. He's giving an argument, a defense of the gospel, and confirmation. The word confirmation means to make it stable and firm and secure. He wants to impart authoritative validity to the gospel here. And so those are very important words for our understanding of where this series is going. I was very pleased when I read Pastor Paul's little greeting and introduction to this series. And if you haven't seen it, you received the message, the TVBF news, look it up. He will elaborate more than I do. But this is the grounding for what we are all about. We want to establish each of us firmly grounded in the faith. And again, I say, since Christianity is a life and belief system, and it is the truth, it is therefore defensible. And we should be prepared to argue for it. Well, I'm not going to be going through the scriptures very much today, because my charge, the topic assigned to me, why we believe God is our creator, can be approached in different ways. And my approach today is going to be not sorting through the biblical grounding for it, but in another sort of argument that I would like to construct. So that's where we're at. And you'll need to follow your notes or have your notes and follow them. I will stick fairly close to them. I wanted to prepare an outline. And then when I started, I prepared pretty much a whole flow of a lecture. And so you have that before you. and you can read in it. Okay, as I state right at the beginning, the title is Why We Believe God is Our Creator. We can look at that as a proposition, as a statement, and one that we want to defend. Or it can be a question. We have to change it a little bit. Why do we believe God is our Creator? That's really part of the answer as well in what I'm doing. So you can look at it as a proposition to defend or a question that we would investigate. Now, I start near the top of the first page, an argument in defense of the proposition or the question. Just follow this little argument. I present it in kind of a linear flowing fashion. It starts with, God exists. Secondly, the Bible is God's authoritative word. It's His revelation to man. The Bible presents God as creator of all things. The Bible then contains convincing evidences of its inherent truthfulness. There are evidences in the Scripture that show us that this truly is speaking the truth. This is God's word in that regard. And then the last statement, therefore, God must be the creator that the Bible declares Him to be. And I say, well, this argument starts with a presupposition, that is a premise. God exists. All arguments, all worldview discussions start with certain premises or presuppositions. There's no way to get around it. But then we have to argue that they're rational, they're sound, they make sense, they hold together, they're coherent, and they conform to what we know is real. I ask a question then. I've given this argument. Is such an argument satisfying? Ask yourself, is this a satisfying argument why we should believe God is our creator? Then I say, is it even a useful one? That's another side to look at it. Then I say, does it qualify as a convincing apology for God as our creator? Is it convincing? Could you present this and it would be a convincing, acceptable proof giving us foundation for why we believe God is our creator? Or can we do better? Well, those are questions. Now, as time permits and how the flow goes here, my intention is to come back to this. But now, let's start with some undeniable principles. First of all, we can say, or we can all agree, that something exists. There is a reality. You're sitting on a real chair next to a real neighbor. This is a real building. You know, you had a real meal. I mean, we live in a real world. All right? The cosmos really exists. When you look out and see the moon, that's the moon. It's not an illusion. We know it's real. We can agree that out of nothing, nothing can come. Now, that's a fundamental statement. I think you can all agree with that. All right? If they didn't put any food on the grill, you wouldn't have had a burger. Because out of nothing, nothing comes. Leave that. And the third point, we can conclude that since something exists, like the cosmos, then the cosmos must either have existed eternally or it had to have an origin in time. Okay? Because it does exist, so it's something real, and it either existed forever or it had a finite origin in time. Those are the only two alternatives, right? And the fourth one, we can agree that if the cosmos had an origin in time, then there must be an originating causal basis for its appearance. It's not just going to appear spontaneously, completely out of its own, is it? There has to be a cause for it, right? I mean, we're reasonable people. I think we can agree on that. I say these are things we can agree on. Now, the issue of eternal existence of space, matter, and energy, and so on, has convincing counterarguments that I'm not even going to address that, to say that the cosmos has existed eternally, just forever. Well, if it always existed, then we don't have to explain its origin, do we? Oh, we got rid of that problem. But there are convincing arguments that that can't be true, scientific and so on. I won't go into that. So now, my opening perspective, I'm setting before you two very contrasting worldviews, and then I will frame how I want to approach our study today. These are two different worldviews. A worldview is a framework, a philosophical framework, for explaining the existence of reality and why it functions or manifests itself in the way it does. Why, you know, how did the cosmos come about? Why does it exist? And how do we explain its function? How do we explain the daily cycle, you know, the rotation of the earth and all kinds of things like that? It's a framework. We're not going into that. And let me just set you a little bit ease. I'm not going into scientific proofs today. That was one way I could approach the subject. I'm not going into the scientific evidences. I've done some of that in the past. But anyway, a worldview. Now, there are two basic, quite contrasting worldviews. So I'm taking the worldviews at the opposite poles, and let's just set them for our discussion. There are other worldviews in between, but this is pretty much it. The first one I call biblical theism and ex nihilo creationism. Ex nihilo means out of nothing. And here are the premises, the prepositions, the presuppositions, I mean, that we follow. First of all, this worldview says a creator, God, exists. Secondly, the Bible is his special revelation. And thirdly, he is the eternal first cause of all reality. That's the creationism part, right? He's the eternal first cause of all reality. He existed before creation, and he is the cause of what we call reality or the cosmos. Now, on the other side of the whole thing, and this is really a dominant worldview in our age, aspects of this just pervade most anything you can pick up and read other than biblical creationism. I call it atheism and scientific naturalism. What are its presuppositions? First, there is no creator. There's no God. Secondly, the Bible is mostly myth and allegory and is unreliable as history and as scientific foundation. And thirdly, the natural material cosmos comprises the full extent of reality. What this present universe is and contains is all there is. Okay? It's all of reality. It's all this physical world. Rules out a spiritual reality, does it not? Immediately, and so on. Well, God doesn't exist, so we don't have to address that. Well, these are opposing, contrasting views. Now, let me say up front that we have these two views, and they're very opposite to each other. One of them can't be right. Okay? We can agree on that. But we also have to recognize that maybe neither of them are right. That's another option, right? Rational discourse, we have to allow that, don't we? Well, you probably trust me that I put one here that we could believe in, and we'll have to decide what that is, okay? Well, the key question at the bottom is, which of the views stated provide the best correspondence with reality? That is, which has the broadest consistency with reality as it's been observed and analyzed and experienced? You see, truth is that which corresponds precisely what's real and experienced, reality. That's what truth is. Okay? If it doesn't correspond with reality, it can't be true. Isn't that? It doesn't make sense, right? And so truth is that which corresponds with reality, and we are going to search for a true worldview foundation. You know, some debaters, as I say in the comment, would immediately say, well, assuming God exists, that's, you cannot prove that. And, of course, you can go back and say, no one can prove that he doesn't exist. That's an impossibility to prove the non-existence of God, because that's trying to prove an absolute negative. You can't do it. So, okay, we're on the same ground here, all right? So now, as I say, my charge is to go head on into this issue here. All right? So, and all of these worldviews start with a presupposition. I've said God exists. I have a very strong bias to that. And let me say, as I say in the notes here, I think, somewhere, that I have reasons for that. And that's what we're here for. We're to find out reasons for what we believe. Just as Paul said, he's there for a defense and confirmation of the gospel. He's there for an apology, an argument, and to set it on firm footing. And so we want to go there. So here's my approach. I better get rolling. I have 6 pages to go through there. I'm going to adopt, in this talk, the contrarian approach. That is, I'm going to take the worldview of atheism, okay, and naturalism. And let's take its tenets and let's look at that and see whether it holds together. Now, clearly, if it cannot be reasoned, then it must crumble. The whole superstructure has to fall and crumble into dust and ashes. Now, we could take the positive approach and look at biblical theism and creationism. I've done that in different times, but now I'd like to take this contrarian approach. And it's my opinion that in coming to this sort of subject matter, it's best to start where we are. What do I mean by that? I'm not going to start with a presupposition that God exists. I'm not there. Okay? I believe it, but let's talk about something that's common to us, that we're all familiar with. Let's start exactly where we are. We meet the world and we meet ourselves before we're really engaged in Scripture. I mean, you know, you're a person, you know that if you, you know, take an apple and drop it, it's going to fall to the floor. I mean, gravity exists. I mean, you know a bunch of these common things. Well, let's start with where we're at and see where we go. And there are 3 areas that I want to address. Natural law, its uniform existence and operation in the natural realm. I mentioned, you know, gravity falls down. You know there's natural law. Somebody turned on the lights. When you switch that on, there is a law of transmission of electricity and the bulbs we have, incandescent bulbs and so on. There's natural laws that define the function of these things. All right? Secondly, we're going to address the issue of self-consciousness and personhood. The essential essence of what it means to be human. And thirdly, moral consciousness and moral discernment. The undeniable active governorship in every person, that every person has a moral conscience. I want to address these 3 areas in sequence. Originally, I was going to do the whole thing on natural law and so on, but I decided I would compact things down, and there's a lot more extensive version that needs to be written, that's partly written, but we're just going to go with this. All right. Now, any worldview must start with presuppositions. And let me put down the presuppositions of naturalism, materialism. I have it there, about a third from the bottom of page 2. What is naturalism? It's the belief that natural laws and natural causes possess the necessary causal power, plus the source of information, to explain the appearance and operation of the entire cosmos. Natural law can explain the origin and the operation and the information that's present in all laws. It can explain that all. That's what naturalism claims. I'll give you some statements just a bit. Materialism, and these are very parallel kind of worldview or philosophical views that come together under what I called atheism and scientific naturalism. Materialism, what is that? It's the belief that the whole of what is real, that is the entire cosmos, is contained entirely within the material realm, within the whole of space, matter, energy, realm of the natural world. It excludes any spiritual dimension. It excludes abstract kind of concepts and things. It's all material. All right. Now, these are belief systems. They're presented as science. This is scientific. You will find that if you read and pursue some of these things. But these are philosophical systems that stand on faith base. Because these premises are, what I've said here, that's taken as statements of faith. They're faith-based. Okay? They're indispensable premises. They're beyond reproof, beyond proof. No one can prove that the material world is all there is. Right? That's assumed. All right? Naturalism. That natural law can explain everything that came into being and how it functions. That's a premise of faith. All right. So, let's go on. The first argument now is that with natural law. And let's address that. This is a fundamental starting point of scientific naturalism. Now, as I say in the level one point, the presumed existence of natural law is taken as having a causeless origin and a universal operation. What does I mean by that? It simply assumes up front that natural law has always functioned, and it functions whenever you have energy, space, or matter. Natural law is always operating, even before matter, energy came into existence. You don't believe me? Look at the first box, quote, on the left side. This comes from Stephen Hawking and his co-author, Mladenow. Let me just read it. Notice what he says in his theory for the origin of the universe. Because there is a law like gravity. Get that. That's really foundational. Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Wow. That's a giant leap. Right? It's okay. I'm going to read on. Spontaneous creation by natural law is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists and we exist. It's not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. It can all happen by natural law. That's naturalism. Now just go across to Peter Atkin's statement. Now we go back in time beyond the moment of creation, before there is anything. Well, of course, Hawking says there was law like gravity before there was anything. I'll say something about that in just a bit. So when there was no time and where there was no space, from this nothing, there came space-time, and with space-time, there came things. In due course, there came consciousness too. And that's my second point when we get to self-consciousness. And the universe, initially non-existent, grew aware. And then he says, and a little further, in the beginning there was nothing. From absolutely nothing, absolutely without intervention, there came into being rudimentary existence. Extreme simplicities emerged from nothing. Well, these are statements by some of the gurus of naturalism and materialism. And they have filtered down in, and they are the underpinnings of evolutionism and many other sorts of things. You know, spontaneous creation and something emerging from nothing are not scientific statements. Yet it's called scientific naturalism. But that's not science, is it? Not at all. Now, I say, to invoke a law of gravity is to invoke the preexistence of something. Right? The law of gravity is not nothing. Well, you can't put it in a box and matter or so on, but it is a law. It is information. It is a mathematical statement. It is a functioning force. It's all these kind of things that we talk about in abstract terms. It is something. It's not nothing. That's what we have to note, first of all. You know, natural law comprises a force principle that operates uniformly in the material realm. Natural law is assumed to be omnipresent. Right? And so on. And these laws, of course, can be expressed mathematically. That is, they communicate information. A law of gravity communicates something. All right? I have down below, next page here, a little picture. Let's not get there quite yet. But mathematics is a abstract formalism that describes a physical force. Okay. Now, just down a little bit below, I have to keep going here. Even natural laws require an efficient cause, both therefore their existence and therefore continued operation. They cannot spontaneously spring from nothing. Can we agree on that? I think we can, right? The laws can't come out of nothing. Sometimes we wonder where our laws come from, but let's not go there. But, all right. Now, in the box I have there, I write, this is from Krauss. Oh, yeah, sure. If the laws of nature are themselves stochastic and random, then there is no prescribed cause for our universe. Under the general principle that anything that is not forbidden is allowed, then we would be guaranteed in such a picture that some universe would arise with the laws that we have discovered. Here's a statement. No mechanism and no entity is required to fix the laws of nature to be what they are. They could be almost anything. And when he uses the word stochastic and random, he's saying it all comes about by chance. The laws came about by chance. And, they could have come about, they could have been almost anything. And if they had been something else, then there would have been a different universe. If they had been a different form, there would have been another universe. If you read the field, there is this whole feeling now of multiverses. Because these laws could make themselves up and we can have multiple universes. Because they're all different, they come into being by chance. Well, all scientific investigation, all historical analysis depend indispensably on this principle, the law of cause and effect. Every effect has to have an antecedent, a previous, efficient cause. You understand that? Nothing happens that's without cause. It has to have a cause. The law of cause and effect. Now this is, to my argument, an abstract principle, right? It's not material. Well, you can't pick up the law of cause and effect. Oh, a law of cause and effect. It's an abstract principle. But you can't do history, you can't do anthropology, you can't do any subject, you can't do science without using this principle of cause and effect. And here, in these statements that I've garnered here from some of the real gurus on the subject, the laws could be anything, and they came out of by chance, or they were existing before there was creation. So it violates that basic principle. Now, I put Newton's law of gravitation there, a little sketch. I give you the equation. I wanted to make a point of this. Time is going to eat me up, I'm afraid. The big M round ball is the mass of the Earth, let's say. The little m off to the right above is the moon. And the force F that's given in the equation, and R is the distance between them, it obeys a mathematical law. Now, you don't have to get involved in mathematics here. I'm not going to explain this thing, but this is what's operating when you have a slice of toast and you put peanut butter and jelly on and you drop it, and it always falls on the jellied side. No, it falls because of gravity, right? It falls because of gravity. It's this force. But notice, I'd like to develop a lot more of this, but I want to do one little thing. You see, in the denominator, there's r to the power 2. It's r squared. You get that? Now, this law, which makes sense and allows us to predict all the orbits in the solar system and beyond and all our satellites and everything, this fundamental law, that's R to the power 2, that is a cardinal number. There is no decimal point. It's not approximately 2.00000. It's 2. It's a cardinal number. And if it came about by chance, if it came about by stochastic or random processes, why would it be precisely 2, a cardinal number? There's no basis for giving an answer to that. Okay, I taught some orbital mechanics and I make something of this, but we won't do it now. But mathematics and the structure of this, it's very precise. See, it's a cardinal number of the exponent. It's not an approximation. You understand what I'm trying to say? There's nothing chance about that. Well, let's go to the next point. I need to run. The next point I'm saying is that, you see, in my argument now, you'll have to read some of the notes. I am going into an abstract level of reasoning, a non-material form of reasoning. I'm under the level 2 point now. Why is there an abstract reality? Well, how can we put together concepts and write out mathematics and find how things work? How can we abstractly come up with this law of cause and effect? Every effect must have an antecedent, efficient cause. And let me say, the cause has to always be greater than the effect. The effect is never greater than the cause. If that's the case, then you could wish and create a world. That's the extreme, right? The effect is always less than the cause. But there we are. And so, we have taken those laws. Now, my point with natural law is there's inconsistencies. They've made presuppositions which are unfounded and so on. But you cannot engage in natural law argument unless you use some of these fundamental abstract principles. Law of cause and effect. Law of non-contradiction. This chair cannot be a chair and the pulpit at the same time in relation to itself. Right? It can't be both. We'll see this in the next argument somewhat. So let me get to, I put together a little syllogism here. I have never taken a course in philosophy, but I know they argue this way. So let's just argue this way as if we're experts. Here we go. Number one, if there are fixed and uniformly valid natural laws, then there must exist a causal, transcendent, personal lawgiver. Now, why do I say that? This is a premise. Well, if there's a law, there has to be a cause. That law is transcendent. It rules over all the cosmos, wherever it is. And a law carries information. Information comes from intelligence. Intelligence is only from a person. Right? That beam has no intelligence. Right? It can't reason, can it? So it has to be personal, and you have to have a lawgiver. If there's a law, there must be a lawgiver. That lawgiver is the cause for the effect, which is the law. Are you understanding what I'm saying? And that law has to come from a person. So that's premise number one. Premise number two, there are fixed and uniformly valid natural laws. Experience proves that to us. You know, if I have my bottle of water here and I drop it, it's going to go down. It's not going to fly up sometime. The law is consistent and it applies, and we know that these laws exist. They're valid. And since they're valid, then the conclusion, there must exist a causal, transcendent, personal lawgiver. Because if there are these laws, they can only come from a personal lawgiver. There are laws, therefore there's a personal lawgiver. So now, we need to believe in a personal lawgiver who's intelligent. That's what I'm trying to say by this argument. Just because there's natural laws and they function. So, there we are. Well, I need to move down. Let's just go down. Skip, you'll read some other things. There's some really good stuff in there, but we're going to skip over it. No, I'm teasing. I'd like to go to the scripture box, Job 38. So I'm arguing here that the existence of law requires a lawgiver, natural law. The existence of abstract laws require a abstract lawgiver. Now we're getting something closer to God, to a spirit. But now, notice the scriptures enforce this idea that there has to be this lawgiver. And I'm going to read from Job 38. If you know, this is where, after Job has gone through everything, Yahweh comes and now speaks to him. And it says, then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me." You know, shut up, Job. It's my turn to talk, and I'm going to teach you something. Okay, so I go down to verse 33, and notice what it says. I like this. I've used this in a number of other contexts. The question to Job is, do you know the ordinances, that is, the laws, the principles, the natural laws, the governing principles of the heavens? Do you know the laws of orbital mechanics, Job? Or fix their rule over the earth? Ah, are you the one that can give them authority that they apply uniformly everywhere? You fix their authority? You cannot violate these laws. You know, you try to violate the law of gravity, you know. Climb up to the roof and jump off. You're not going to fly up. See, he's fixed their rule. They're trustworthy laws. Why should they apply everywhere? And Yahweh asks him the question. So in the little box below, I say now in my comments, the laws of nature exist only because God, the personal intelligent greater, wills them to exist. And then in the second paragraph, since I must move along, the atheist naturalist has no causal explanation for their origin or for their operational force or their fixity. Why should they always apply? Why doesn't, when we come to 2017, why doesn't the law of gravity change something? We trust it's going to be the same. Now, why should you be able to trust it's going to be the same? You can only trust that the law is going to be the same because the eternal, immutable God has ordained the law. And He doesn't change. He's ordained it. We have an answer for that. We have a causal answer. They have no causal answer. So, I feel bad that I rush over some of that one on natural law. I was going to spend the full lecture on that. So you realize that I'm just hurting inside to leave some of that. But I want to go to the next arguments. I set it up this way. Let's go to a different argument. Let's step away from natural law, away from science now for a bit. What we've seen is that since there is natural law, there must be a personal, intelligent lawgiver because laws, the cause, there has to be a cause for the effect, and it has to be an intelligent cause. And intelligence is a personal quality, and so on. And he had to be eternal. He had to be existing before there was creation. Now, the second point is the argument from self-consciousness and personhood. I said I want to start where we can relate. I'm starting with the self-evident truth about myself. I exist. You can say that to yourself, right? You know you exist. And if you want to use René Descartes' argument, I think, therefore I am. He says, I can't even doubt without thinking. Right? You can't, you know, doubting is a method of thinking. And I'm thinking, and he came to that realizing, we think it's a silly little statement. But when he came to understand that, I am a self-conscious person. And I possess self-conscious personhood. The cause must be another self-conscious person that has brought this kind of existence to me. And he went straightway to an argument for the existence of God. Let me develop it a little bit here, briefly. The stage one questions, from whence is self-conscious personhood derived? From whence does a person derive it? Did you get it from yourself? Well, that's nonsense, because that violates the law of contradiction. A non-contradiction, because I can't be a creature. be a non-person and a person at the same time if I'm going to create self-consciousness within myself. You understand what I say? You can't be both at the same time. I mean, it's nonsense. So that can't be the answer. The second stage question. Does it derive from my parents? Did you get your personhood from your parents? Well, if so, you know, then it follows by deduction that your parents obtained it from their parents. And so you go down the family tree. Parents, you got personhood from the parents, from the parents, and pretty soon you get to the stump of the tree, right? You get to the originating parents. Where did personhood and self-consciousness come from? Why are we self-conscious people? And I trust that you don't deny that you are. My third great question, you know, where did the original set of parents obtain their personhood? See, if we go down the tree all the way, we arrive at an impasse. And our options are twofold. Either self-conscious personhood was created by the original parents. They created it by themselves. Well, we've got to rule that out. Or it was created by an eternally self-existent person and then externally implanted in the original creature parents. That is, a real soul essence is placed in the physical essence of the very first parents. Either that, or they created it by themselves. Adam and Eve created their own personhood. Well, that violates the law, the abstract laws. You see, we have to reason abstractly there, that violates the law of non-contradiction. And I have to have a cause for it. And the effect is personhood. Where did it come from? It has to come from a person. The effect of personhood must come from personhood. The effect of self-consciousness must come from self-consciousness. Right? Because the effect can never be greater than the cause. So logic affords no alternatives. And there we are. And now I'm dropping down a bit here. Sorry, but that's just the way it is. Self-consciousness is a non-material essence intrinsic to personhood. I say here, on page 5, the ability to think, to doubt, to act with intention, to have affections, to possess and assert moral consciousness, to be exercised in abstract moral spiritual reasoning, all of these personal attributes are part of self-consciousness, right? And so they have to have a cause for all of them in that way. And, you know, if people lose their arm or lose their leg, become incapacitated, we have our great heroes returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, we're losing limbs, they can still think, they can reason, they still have self-consciousness, do they not? Without limbs. I don't need all my physical body to do that. It's not a material thing. Well, so that's part of the point here. I jotted down this one thing by Peter Apke. Well, let me just use Richard Dawkins. He says, love is a product of highly complicated equipment of some sort. He doesn't know what it is. And Peter Atkins says that at the deepest level, decisions come about from dispositions in molecules inside large numbers of cells. Those are the guys who wrote some of the earlier statements there. Because to admit it otherwise, they have to have a cause for self-consciousness. And the presuppositions of their view must crumble and fall. Okay. Well, so the truth naturally raises the following question. Is a material, non-personal cause sufficient for the effect of a non-material personal reality? Near the top of page 5. The answer is, of course, no. And the next one is, does self-consciousness and personhood find its origin and fountain solely within the structure of matter and energy, arising spontaneously out of processes described by natural law? That's what atheism and scientific naturalism says, that it happens by natural law out of matter energy. That's where your self-consciousness came from. There is no answer to that. So, my third one there, the bullet, is can chance, that is non-intentional, uncontrolled interactions of matter-energy, be a sufficient underlying cause for the existence of cell consciousness and for all the capacities applied in true personhood? I wrote this sentence, and I'd like to read it to you. If the answer to these questions is yes, then reason is irrational. The underpinning principles of logical analysis are illogical, and language is devoid of capacity to communicate truthfully. If those things hold, then we are just a mass of fusion of molecules, and we can't reason and rationally that way. So self-consciousness in a creature must be an effect, and that effect must be a personal transcendent cause that had to pre-exist, had to be there before self-consciousness came. That's why we believe God's our creator, because you have self-consciousness. You can use that argument. Someone doesn't want to believe God is the creator. Where did you get your self-consciousness from? What makes you a person? It only comes about because the personal, self-conscious, personal creator, eternally existing before, created us in his own image, planted in our original parents that image, and he plants it in every embryo. He plants it in every individual. That's why life is sacred, and even preborn life. Because God has planted something very special and unique in his creative genius in every individual. So that's one an argument for. Let me go to argument three quickly here. The argument from moral consciousness and moral discernment. My postulate is, there exists in every person a moral consciousness which is manifested in, first, an innate disposing sense of moral discernment and moral oughtness. Every person has a sense of moral oughtness. That is, you can distinguish what I ought to do and what I ought not to do. Everybody has a, let's call it a conscience. Okay? You have a conscience. And the second thing it manifests itself as is a sense of guiltiness associated with recognized violation of moral oughtness. When we transgress what we morally believe we ought to do, we all have a sense of guilt. I have it, and therefore I know you have it. We all have the same kind of self-consciousness. Not only that, but also there's a consequent, inescapable fear of ultimate judgment. Right? Guilt carries with it a fear of judgment. So now my follow-on question. These are questions which must receive reasoned answers in a consistent worldview. A consistent worldview must provide some answers for this moral consciousness. First question, what is the moral first cause underlying the existence of an acknowledged universal moral code? That's a question. You can ask that kind of question in some kind of conversation if you're dealing with a naturalist who committed to scientific naturalism. Second question, does not a universal moral consciousness rationally require the a priori existence of a transcendent personal or moral cause? If there is a universal moral consciousness in man, then it's inherent in the personhood of every creature. And since there has to be an efficient cause for every effect, there has to be a sufficient, efficient cause for this effect of moral consciousness. So I say there has to be a transcendent, personal, and moral first cause. Okay? Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, 1800s, so on, did some devastating things, but a very brilliant guy. He said, it's a quote that I have in my stuff for him, "There are two things I cannot explain. I cannot explain the starry skies above and the moral law within." There's no explanation for that. He ruled out the creatorship of God. Immanuel Kant, he kind of dismissed all the arguments of the previous Augustines, Aquinas, and many others down the line. But he still can't explain the starry heavens. But in particular, he says, the moral law within. Okay? And there we are. Now, I have put several tiers of questions together with different sorts of bullets. Let me just read a couple of these under the square bullet. Just questions to ask for us to think about where this moral consciousness could come from. How can a personal attribute spring spontaneously from a purely material causal source? That is, if we have a moral essence to us, how can that come from a purely material source? It can't. It has to be personal. It has to be from a moral person, a person of moral fiber. The second square bullet. Is it reasonable to assume that universal standards of right and wrong can arise spontaneously in every generation and among all people groups without a transcendent personal moral first cause? And then the third one, does not the spontaneous appearance of moral standards without the preexistence of a moral law of human nature violate the law of cause and effect? You see, I'm arguing again with this abstract law. And I want to make a comment about that very soon because we're almost there. You can jot this verse down. It's Isaiah 57:15. Here, Yahweh says, "Thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity." See, the scriptures affirm all these principles we're saying. He's the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, the Holy One. Okay? He's the one who inhabits eternity. He's there before it all happened, and he's personal in that regard. Now, I'm going to read the last two there with a little kind of dagger arrowhead. My question is, why is there a pervasive sense of guilt among all people if there is no transcendent personal and moral first cause? Why is that? Where does guilt come from? And second, why does a pervasive sense of ultimate judgment and justice exist if no transcendent personal and moral judge, who is the Creator, exists? Can one speak of justice if no ultimate moral judge exists? That's nonsense. How do you speak of justice? It's off the subject and it's completely peripheral, but I have an argument just on the basis of guilt and this sense of ultimate justice for the existence of Yahweh. That's couple-page thing that I have, but that's something else. Now, I want to read the box on the left, the big box. It comes from C.S. Lewis. It's a wonderful statement. And it's in Mere Christianity. In fact, it's in Part 1. And the title to Part 1 is this. C.S. Lewis wrote it down. It's very good. Right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. He directs this first part of his book on Mere Christianity, and that's his title of the first part. Then he has a number of chapters, which he wrote or speeches he gave on the BBC during a World War II or something about that time. But right and wrong is a clue to the meaning of the universe, he said. But this is a statement in there. If anyone will take the trouble to compare the moral teaching of, say, the ancient Egyptians, Babylonians, Hindus, Chinese, Greeks, and Romans, what will really strike him will be how very like they are to each other and to our own. There are two points I want to make. First, that human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not in fact behave in that way. They know the law of human nature and they break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe we live in. That's the statement. Now, just to the side of that, I give you a couple naturalist statements. William Provine, no ultimate foundations for ethics exist. No ultimate meaning in the life exists. Boy, he must be an unhappy guy, or I don't know. It must be really hard to live, right? No ultimate meaning, no basis of ethics, so there's no moral conscience. Doesn't he have a sense of moral consciousness? Doesn't he understand that? I don't understand how they can write like that. Now, Steven Weinberg, this famous Nobel Prize-winning physicist, I believe is in Texas now, was at Cornell. I think that the part of the historical mission of science has been to teach us that we are not the playthings of supernatural invention, that we can make our own way in the universe, and that we have to find our own sense of morality. Get that? We've got to find our... He is an avowed scientific naturalist. We've got to find our own sense of morality. The question, again, I come back to, there is, as C.S. Lewis clearly points out, a universal moral consciousness, moral discernment, a sense of moral oughtness. It can only come from a transcendent, personal, moral first cause. Got it? We reason from this fundamental, abstract principle. It's not a material principle. It's a thought principle. All right? Then I give you three scriptures that show that this difference between good and evil is well known. Right at the beginning, Genesis 3:22, then Yahweh Elohim said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil." Our first parents knew good and evil. Then you go forward, and Solomon is becoming king, and he prays. What does he ask for? 1 Kings 3:9, "So give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, to discern between good and evil." And then Hebrews 5:14, "But solid food is for the mature, who because of practice have their senses trained to discern good and evil." The scriptures speak directly, they speak pervasively to a moral sense that everybody has between good and evil. Well, I've kind of come to the end. There's a conclusion there. I want to wrap a couple things up, but I want to make a point now. I said in this lecture, why we believe God is our creator, I wanted to start where we are. We all experience natural law, and gravity is the easiest one for us, most common one that we can relate to, but all natural law. Then, self-consciousness and personhood. We all know we exist, right? We can reason. We can make choices ability to do these things. And we all have a moral conscience. Now, in every one of these cases, we had to appeal to a transcendent first cause in order to satisfy such a principle as cause and effect, the fundamental laws, abstract principles. We had to do that. And I said I wanted to reason. You know, like Isaiah says, "Come now, let us reason together," just from our basic where we are. And we've reasoned kind of in the plane of where we live with these things. But in every case, we have had to do something very profound. We have had to resort back to the existence of God. You get that? We had to resort back to a lawgiver. We had to resort back to a pre-existent, an eternal person, self-conscious, personal creator, in order to understand our self-conscious personalness. We had, in the case of the moral consciousness, we had to resort back to a moral first cause. You see, even when we try to reason horizontally, we cannot reason without adopting, importing the fact that God exists, because He creates the capacity for everyone to reason. And as I say there, anyone who even wants to contrive an argument against the existence of God has to resort to reason. But he cannot reason without these laws that make logical sense. So the existence of God, we believe God is our creator because the argument for his existence is a transcendental argument. You cannot even argue without appealing to his existence. I don't know whether you've caught that theme, but that is the undercurrent theme in all of what I've put forward here. And I found this some time ago, Cornelius Van Til's thing on the bottom of the page. I want to read it. I hold that belief in God is not merely as reasonable as other belief, or even a little or infinitely more probably true than other belief. I hold rather that unless you believe in God, you can logically believe in nothing else. You better look at that and read that again. Because if you don't believe in God, you can't reason logically. And so therefore you can't logically believe in anything else. And since that's the case, we are compelled to believe that God is our creator. And you can go with a solid foundation of faith that we have a creator, Elohim, in the beginning, created all things. Now, if you'll go back to the front page, I made kind of the insinuation that in that argument at the top there, to start with, God exists. And then the Bible's God's authoritative word. The Bible presents God as creator of all things. The Bible contains convincing evidence of its own inherent truthfulness, and therefore God must be the creator because the Bible proclaims him to be. And I say right underneath there, this is a decidedly circular argument. Is it not? We end up where we started. But folks, I don't like to go just straightforward like this. I argued from where we are and things, but I'm going in a circular fashion. Do you understand that? Because we've reasoned from natural things that we all know exist and experience, but we had to use arguments that forced us to go up to the presupposition that God must exist, because abstract laws of knowledge and so on are all exist because that's how he created the world. That's how he created you and me. And you cannot logically not believe. You can't logically disbelieve, as Cornelius Van Til says. You missed the boat. So these are a different sort of arguments. I hope that if you read through that, you might be something that you will find important, but please understand that. And now next week, Pastor Randy will be here, and why believe the Bible is the Word of God? Well, we've set the foundation, have we not? Because we need God as the Creator, or we can't even argue. We can't even reason. There's no reasonable basis whereby we can reason if we don't believe that God is our Creator. And so now the table is set for Randy to lead you in a feast next week. Let's bow in prayer. Father, it is just so marvelous in my mind to understand the glory of who you are as our Creator, the high and lofty one and the holy one. And you have so, in your infinite wisdom, designed, created, ordered this creation such that no one can miss the reality of who you are. Father, we acknowledge that we are entirely dependent on you, not just for our breath and life, but for the very mental processes we have, for the very self-consciousness we have, and that without this foundation as you, a creator, death is a monster. Father, I thank you that you have revealed yourself to us in a true and living word and through your beloved Son. And through him, we have reasoned foundation for the gospel. And I pray that you would strengthen each one here this evening in their own discipleship and sharpen each one of us in our own understanding of how to live and move and have our being as lights in this present world. I pray that you will accomplish your good purpose out of our gathering, for I commit it to you and for your glory. Amen.